Estrepus 7, the end. He stood up and lit another cigarette, blew out the first deep breath of it, and said to me, "You can't get to where you're going unless you come the way you've gone." I had no idea what he meant. We left the bedroom together. Because we had been in the dark so long, the light in the hall too bright. I felt a little dizzy in it, or it was his story, I don't know. Everything seemed to have a vague meaning, and when I saw Haywire across the room, he looked at me like he knew what we'd been talking about. And he was something more vulnerable than he was before. I guess I felt sorry for him. Seeing his guitar made me remember the things I'd been told. Miss Hellman said to Mr. Hammett as we came into the living room, "Oh, there you are. We've got a train to catch. I will get our coats." Looking at her wristwatch, Mrs. Parker announced, "Time doth flit. Oh, shit." And she got up, too. Mr. Benchley also stood. I saw that Billy had already gone. I would not ever see him again. Haywire escorted the departing guests to the door. Sophie must be in the kitchen, I guessed. Mr. Bogart and Miss Bacall were seated on the sofa against the window, speaking quietly and intimately. It was lightly raining outside. Mr. Hammett nodded to me from the door under his slouched fedora, "Good luck." And I said, "You too." And that seemed like a stupid thing to say, I thought to myself, as soon as I had said it. Haywire kissed Miss Hellman and said he'd see her in New York in a few days. He told Hammett something and patted his right arm. He shut the door and came back. Mr. Bogart stood and took Miss Bacall's hand to help her stand and said they would be going to bed and asked if they would see him in the morning. Haywire assured them that they would and showed them to the bedroom set aside for them. I stood looking at the window, at the sparkle of city lights on fresh raindrops, gleaming beads on the glass of the window, and at the glowing globes of creamy mist around the streetlights below. It had rained while Mr. Hammett and I had been talking in the bedroom. The individual round raindrops on the glass, each luminous, each illuminated within themselves, made individual round images of the street and the lights, each a capsule of what is around them all. The round world within as the round world without. Just as each of us are alone and the same, I thought. Each drop holding in its own self the image of the world around it, as large or as small as it is, the same in each, large or small, unique as itself, just as we are, each of us the same and unique. And even as they get smaller and smaller and smaller and are taken up into the air, just pinpoints of mist, are still perfect and round, pinpoints and still a capsule containing all that is. And even if taken up completely into the sky and carried away and absorbed, each remains the tiniest drop, still holding within itself an image of everything around it. So nothing is lost. Nothing is lost in the round sky that holds us all, though everything rises and goes away. I wish I could talk to you, Maybell. I so much wish I could. Sophie had come up behind me while I was looking at the window, and she said, "It's pretty." Yes, I said. I wished I could explain to her what I was thinking, but the sense of it vanished. Haywire, coming back, offered to make me a drink as he made one for himself, and when I declined, he said we should all go to bed. There was much to do tomorrow. Sophie began to thank him, but he stopped her with a raised hand and explained he really wanted her to stay, that the bedroom off the kitchen, where Mr. Hammett and I had been, was intended for a maid or other servant, and that he did not want her to feel that that is how he felt about her. But he wanted her to stay, to be comfortable. She said she had not come prepared to stay. He assured her she would find everything she needed. He had anticipated and really wanted her to stay. She shook her head, but she smiled and said, "You is a strange man, Mr. Mather. Call me Jonathan, please." At 4 in the morning, a doorbell rang to the suite, like it was a real house. I heard it, but thought it was a dream. Haywire got up to answer it and woke me soon after, saying there was a telegram addressed to him, but it concerned me. The telegram said that Sister Kinney was looking for me, that it was urgent, that if he knew where I was, then he should send me to the hospital right away. I did not know what to do. I got up. I stood in the living room with him while he explained all this and showed me the telegram that he had torn open. It lay on the piano. Mr. Bogart and soon after Miss Bacall came out of their bedroom in their night clothes, asking what was wrong. I explained about my daughter, her polio, how her mother had died. He said, "We should go right now." I did not understand, but Haywire immediately went to the phone. Mr. Bogart started to say something to Miss Bacall, but she said, "Way ahead of you, kid," and went back to the bedroom. Off the phone, Haywire returned to where I stood and said to Mr. Bogart, "You don't mind, do you?" "Are you kidding?" he asked. He looked at me and said, "You need to pack." I was confused. Haywire said he had called the airport and had his pilot awakened, and they would gas up and be ready soon. That Bogart was going to fly back in the morning to Hollywood anyway, so this was just a little earlier. They will drop you at the Wold Chamberlain in Minneapolis on their way to the coast. Sophie had heard us and had got up to see and had come out of her bedroom, cinching some silk wrapper Haywire had somehow anticipated having for her. A full wardrobe, in fact, having been set for her in the closet and drawers, which she had no idea would be her own, but there it is. Haywire explained it to her and asked if she would go with me, said it was a kindness to him if she would. She said she did not know, that her mother was alone and would be expecting her. It was bad enough that she had not gone home last night, and she would be worried. Haywire said he would call her and asked for the telephone number. Sophie said they had no phone. "Well, give me the address then, and I will go see her myself and explain." "I don't know," Sophie said. "Maybe." She looked at Haywire like she meant to scold him. "Mind you, don't scare her. I am a gentleman. She don't like white folk. I will go with my hat in my hand." Looking him over, she considered and then said, "Well, that will help, I guess." But then added with a finger pointed to his face, "You stoop a bit, too." "Yes, ma'am," Haywire said. "Okay," she agreed, looking at me. "I'll make some coffee. You go pack." Haywire said he'd make the coffee and all of us should pack. He brought Sophie his alligator suitcase to use for her own. She packed her new clothes and I mine. It was strange to do, but it seemed silly to leave them too. But I could take no pleasure in it, thinking about Mary Lee and her suffering, her being alone when she needed me. I just wished I had never come, and I was angry at myself for not being there with her when she needed me. Still, I suppose I'd still be in Seattle if I'd gone on with my regular work and not come to Washington. Going by plane, at least, Haywire said, I'd be home before supper. I would see what was wrong then. I did not think of it until we were well up in the air, but of course, we could have called long distance. I did not think of it because, like Sophie, I don't have a phone in my home either. I'd always used Sam's phone, and people called me that way, too. That's why they could not reach me. I should have had a phone. Maybelle always said I should. I should have called, I said out loud. And Mr. Bogart said he was sorry he'd not thought of it either. The private plane was a DC-6. It could maybe seat 80 or 90 folk as a normal commercial plane. But it had been remade for him with an interior like a long living room with lounge chairs, settees, and a bar, a kitchen in back, and a pair of bedroom suites. The propellers blurred and blasted the air. The engines were already hot and roaring when we boarded. We climbed stairs and got in behind the cockpit, where the door to it was open, and where the pilot was turned in his seat to greet us, sitting before a complex, tiered console of 100 lit-up gauges, needles shivering under their arcs of glass, thousands of identical switches. He smiled up at us, recognizing Mr. Bogart, and shouted over engine noise that he was glad to see him again, and was called his own first name by Mr. Bogart in reply. When we settled into seats and buckled up, I said to Sophie, I don't know what I should do if something happens to her. I think I'll want to die. Don't say that, Sophie said, shaking her head at me. The clouds were low, still misting. The plane took off over the Potomac. Looking down, the water of the river was as gray as the mist streaming by us, striping our windows. The choppy liftoff frightened me, but Mr. Bogart winked at me and gave me a thumbs up. I smiled back. I had always heard about being airsick, but I wasn't. Once we were above clouds, it was so beautiful that to look out the windows, I lost myself in what I saw. The sun coming up came in blindingly through the portal window beside me. And looking out to see from where it came, I saw the rosy gleam rising and higher up spill like paint and color the carpet of clouds that went all across underneath us. Then the plane banked as the engines groaned, and we headed away from the sharp light and into a night, rapidly lifting into a new day. It was a long flight, but in less time than it might have taken me to get to Pittsburgh by train, I would be home. I did not think, tried not to think of what it may be. Maybelle had been in an iron lung too before she died. I say what I'm thinking out loud to Sophie. She looks at me sadly. I look out the window. The sky is separate from the earth, perfectly clear. The earth is lost beneath the clouds. We were served breakfast by a young lady, like the young lady back in the Palmer House, well-dressed, well-mannered, another college girl, I guess. Where does he get these girls? She made omelets. Sophie was hungry enough to eat mine. I couldn't eat. We dropped out the sky and back into clouds and got tossed and bounced about until we were below the ripping clouds. And I saw wet farmlands in blocks and patches below us, and some toy buildings and tiny cars on wet black lines. We landed in Detroit to refuel, Bogart explained. The ground crew hurried. Mr. Bogart asked if I wanted to go inside the hangar and see if we might call long distance. I said, no, I couldn't worry less if I knew more. He nodded. Miss Bacall said I was a wise man for my age. I don't feel wise. Sophie looked like she was going to say something, but I was just as glad she didn't. I really didn't want to talk about it. Mr. Bogart said we'd be there in just a couple hours now. When we landed, the clouds had all spread apart for a blue sky and had got into small flocks moving slow. And while it had been raining in Minneapolis, too, the streets were no longer wet, though sometimes rain still on the leaves came off the boulevard trees with the breezes and splattered the taxi windshield. The driver let it sheet off as he drove without turning on his wipers. He went very fast. He had been told to go fast by Mr. Bogart himself, and it was something of an adventure for him. Sophie sat at the other side of the back seat with me. Miss Bacall had kissed my cheek when we parted. Mr. Bogart had called me by my first name and said he would say a prayer to the Virgin. I didn't even know he was religious. It was just about supper time when we got there. I could smell the meals in the air of the place when they opened the door for us. I went straight to the conservatory. Mary Lee's iron lung was in the center among the other girls. It was empty. Oh, God, Maybelle. I looked up then in the vault of glass above me, golden with sunset, and I wished to God it would crash down on me and cut me to death. I wished I might be stabbed to death. I wept. I fell to my knees, and I wept. And then, from behind me, came Sister Kenny, calling my name, distressed, despairing for me. And then, calling for me too, but happily, sweetly, was Mary Lee. I stood, and turning, saw Mary Lee leave Sister Kenny's side, letting go of her hand, to walk gingerly toward me, saying, "Look, Daddy." Oh, Maybelle, how beautiful our daughter is. Sophie took my hand.
Jesu Kristo Mwokozi wetu, tutashangilia daima, na una hamu ya kwenda kwetu, si mbali karibu, tutaimba na sisi. Simbali karibu tutaimba na sisi.